And we picked up hard rock wood certified.
I call to order the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. Today's Thursday, February 9th. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2405. And I would like to ask Ren Lino, Chuck Sams, and Cameron Smith to join us.
We'll talk some more.
Great. Thanks for being here. Mr. Chairman, you want to start us off?
Okay. Thank you, Chairman Clem and the committee. My name is Ren Lino. I am the chairman of the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde and a member of the Oregon Department of Veterans Advisory Committee. Thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you today. Oregon is truly unique when it comes to the relationship between state and tribes. Together, we have done amazing things, from Governor Attia and the creation of the Commission on Indian Services to Governor Kitzhaber's executive order 9630 and then passage of SB 770, which put into statute the government-to-government relation. We should all be proud as Oregonians of work done to solidify a strong bond between state and the tribes. Confederated Tribes supports House Bill 2405, which would make funding assistance available to tribal governments for construction and restoration of memorials honoring veterans. I would also like to urge the legislature to support the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs and to utilize additional funding approved through the Measure 96 above that which is currently budgeted veterans are underserved. More than two-thirds of the 350,000 veterans in Oregon are not receiving federal services and connected to services and severely delayed. As you know, the Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde has an agreement with the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs that allows the tribes to serve Native veterans through our tribal health clinic. By allowing tribal clinics to provide health care to Native veterans as well as to be reimbursed for that care through the Department of Veterans Affairs, tribes help Native veterans living in rural areas who cannot access to travel to Veterans Affairs facilities in Portland and in many cases prefer to be seen by cultural sensitive providers. HB 2405 is a solid step in the right direction, and we ask that you also help to create legislation that allows Oregon tribes to serve non-Native veterans who live in rural communities as either spouses or residents, but also face the same logistical problems in accessing health care. And before closing, I'd just like to say some personal comments. As far as the funding for veterans, I personally have gone through trying to get something done, and I think here's one of the main problems. The mentality of you going to the veterans and trying to get some help and coming away feeling that you are a mere statistic needs to change. I am a U.S. Marine who served in Vietnam, so I've got a lot of knowledge of that. When I was 18, 19 years old, I was there. And these people that people look at as statistics are your lifeline home, and you were theirs. So for me, we need to change the mentality. I think Oregon looks at being very proud of some of the stuff they do or the things that they do, but we need to be proud of how we take care of our veterans. We need to set the bar, not the minimum. So I'd like to ask that our funding, I think the people of Oregon spoke very clear on 86. It wasn't give them here and take away there. And I know the difficult job you have. I'm a 21-year council member from a tribe who came from nothing to something. We had a successful casino, but our money all goes to our tribal membership, and it's a difficult task to keep them services coming. But I think it's not about money sometimes. It's just about what's right and wrong. And I think it's wrong to deduct that money. I think we need to keep that money in there. And like I said, I think we need to set the standard, not the minimum. Thank you.
Thank you. And let's see. Chuck, would you like to go next?
Good morning, Chairman Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Charles F. Sams III. I am the Communications Director for the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation. I'm also a Navy veteran, having served on active duty from 1988 to 1992 and active reserves from 1992 to 1995. The CTYR is one of two treaty tribes in the state of Oregon, and I'm pleased to be here on behalf of the tribe to speak in support of House Bill 2405. American Indians serve in the armed forces in greater numbers per capita than any other ethnic group, and they have served with distinction in every major conflict for over 200 years. Our tribe alone has a record of over 650 veterans who have served the United States since the Indian Wars to present day. Oregon's tribes honor community members who serve in the military in many ways, including with veterans' memorials. The Confederated Tribes Umatilla Indian Reservation built the Nihiawe Warrior Memorial in 1996. It's an important public gathering place for veterans and for our part of Oregon. In 2015, we applied for a state parks grant for veteran and war memorials to increase ADA accessibility, restore weathered plaques and walls, improve security lighting, upgrade outdated electrical, install security cameras, and install post and cable fencing to reduce potential safety hazards. The Umatilla Board of Trustees authorized the matching funds for this. After submitting the application, State Parks identified that tribal governments were not eligible for grants. We were told, they told us that the Veterans and War Memorial Funds were limited to statute to local governments. We have since learned that other tribes have run into the same challenge. Tribal governments act in many ways like Oregon's local government. We fulfill the roles of municipal, county, state, and national government. Enrolled tribal members are proud citizens of the great state of Oregon and have served our nation well. We believe these funds should be available to support all veterans in our great state. We ask the House Agriculture and Natural Resource Committee to support this bill and to provide a due pass recommendation to your colleagues on the floor of the House of Representatives. Thank you.
Thanks, Cam.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Cameron Smith, the director of the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs, and pleased to be here in support of House Bill 2405. I want to thank Chair Lena for serving on our advisory committee and giving a plug for our budget, even though this isn't Ways and Means here. Thank you, sir. And he is a member of my tribe, the United States Marine Corps, so we have that shared brotherhood, both across branches. But he is a proud Vietnam veteran, like Representative Esquivel. And our Vietnam veterans not welcomed home in their own time, and they are standing up for our current generation of veterans, so thank you. And as was mentioned, our tribal veterans have served at a higher level per capita than any other group, and that is simply incredible when you think of the long and challenging history between our tribal nations and the federal government. But our tribal members have never hesitated to stand up and defend what is our shared homeland and what was our tribal nation's home long before there was a state of Oregon or a United States of America. And our tribal culture is a warrior culture that stands up for its members who are veterans and all veterans. So I would encourage us to make this cleanup to this statute, to incorporate them into this grant for the memorials, and to take to heart on this tribal day here at the Capitol, take to heart the government-to-government relations that we have and that we've heard at so many different summits, to incorporate the tribal perspective, not on the back end, but try to do that listening on the front end and incorporate their input into legislation, into programs, and into policies before we create the statutes. So thank you very much, and happy to take any questions.
Any questions for this panel? Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I would just like to first of all, welcome you to our committee. I serve as a representative from the Oregon House on the Legislative Commission on Indian Services and am familiar with a great deal of the work that you do and appreciate the government-to-government relationship that we have not only with the tribes that you represent but with the other seven. And I appreciate, Cam, your comments about why this is an important cleanup. This is tidying up something that we need to take care of, and I appreciate you being here to represent this issue and to represent not only I love your definition, sir, of the tribe that you're defining of military veterans who have served. So thank you for drawing our attention to that. But I think this is a very appropriate bill. I appreciate you bringing it, and it's time to get these things cleaned up, and let's take care of it. So I clearly support it, and thank you for championing it today.
Thank you.
Representative Esquivel?
Thank you.
Or Representative Witt, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Gentlemen, thank you very much for your very forceful and compelling statements. And thank you for the good work that you're doing on behalf of all veterans in this state. Mr. Leno, I just want to tell you that I agree with your analysis that measure is 86, yes, was additive and not backfill. And I suspect, sir, that if we were to go out on the street and ask the first 10 voters to pass by us, they'd agree with us, too. Thank you for your statement.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Welcome home. Welcome home. We are embarking upon a memorial down in Southern Oregon. We're doing a replica, 80% replica of the Vietnam Wall. And so I understand how expensive it is. So I hope that we get this squared away so you can, in fact, get some help with this. So I hope you can do it.
Please.
Just a little follow-up on our memorial. We're very fortunate. Like I said, we have a casino, but our memorial in our community of Willamina, Grand Round, Willamina, and Sheridan, we actually wanted it to mean something, so we just didn't take casino money and go and buy it. Our community actually raised money for 5 years, so it does mean a lot to communities, not only the veterans, but their families. We got over 2,000 names on that memorial now. And it's a beautiful memorial right there at our tribe. So when you look at the tribes and how we take care, we have to take care of these, I will say whenever you go to a powwow or something, our veterans are honored. They come in behind the color guard and the leadership of the tribe anywhere you go. So that's how we do it, and that's how why we want this bill to be supported and passed.
Thank you.
Great. Any further questions or comments? Okay, thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you very much.
And does anybody have technical questions? We do have the Parks Department here if you had questions about the way it works, but it's somewhat straightforward, I know. Yeah. Okay, I think we're covered then. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2405, and we'll expect to pass this out of committee next week when we have our paperwork back. And I'd like to open a public hearing now on House Bill 2318 and ask M.G. Devereaux and Katie to come.
Lisa.
No, Lisa, yeah, I'm just reading off my script, sorry.
Sometimes I crack myself.
And is Todd here too?
Todd is here as well.
There you go. Why don't you come on up so we get a full stack. Mr. Perry likes to have the whole thing to himself, so we can accommodate that too right now. We do this. Please tell us about this bill.
Awesome. Good morning, Chair Clem and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Lisa Sumption. I'm the director at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. With me today is my deputy director, G. Devereaux, and Todd Davidson from Travel Oregon. So before I get into the heart of our testimony, I want to take an opportunity to reintroduce you to your state park system. Sometimes when you live with something long enough, it starts becoming very, very much part of the fabric and you take it for granted. So I just want to let you know that in 1922, we received our very first donation from Willamette Valley resident Sarah Helmick, and that started the system, which is a fairly small system compared to the size of Oregon and our population. We're at 109,000 acres with 255 properties, but it's one of the most popular state park systems in the nation. We'd like to think we're number one, but so chances are that you visited recently or you in your district have one of these special places, like Silver Falls, Crown Point Vista House, the Cove Palisades, or the Oregon Coast. We're very blessed to have the Oregon Coast as one of our very large and special state parks. So we, at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, we're the state's leader in outdoor recreation. We're the biggest advocate, serving residents in every county, primarily through like our local government grant program. And we host over 1 million visitors in a biennium. People get a lot from there, and most of those parks are in rural locations. We're not generally an urban location. We're very rural. People get a lot of time from their time in the park. They get things like joy, inspiration, health, education, wellness, and just that family bonding and that connection to Oregon's fabric. But they're practical efforts, too. Effects, sorry. Like an estimated $1.7 billion for local economies. In the past 95 years, leadership has changed, but our vision has not. Our mission has not. Our department has pretty much stayed very core on the fact that we're here to protect special places that are essential to our identity and our fabric as Oregonians, and that we provide the greatest experiences possible in those places. We think ahead. We take the long view to make sure that we're thinking about what's coming next, and we do everything that we can do to make sure that our system is going to be thriving for the next generation. There are lots of other public lands in Oregon, but we would submit that our state park system stands as an Oregon ideal. So it's our drive to look ahead and take the long view that brings us here today into this bill. As we approach 100 years of service in 2022, we're looking ahead to the next century, and we realize that we need to be doing more. We need to be reaching more people in every community. We need to make sure that we're allowing the strength of the current park system carry it into the future. At the same time, we need to have the courage to change. We have been operating the state park system the same way for decades. We started our camping rates in, I think, 1951, and it's the same structure. So we're not tax-funded, and Oregonians are very happy to support the small amounts that they pay for their parks when they're camping and day visiting us. We earn our revenue by visitors providing great experiences, and those funds go right back into the system. But the current approach to fees is very much a one-size-fits-all, and it's a very old approach. So to protect and maintain our special places and to reach new people, we're proposing a new approach to the way we set our camping rates. We have the ability now to discount and waive fees, which we do. We waive about a $1.6 million between our vets program and our foster and adoptive programs. But we don't have the ability to offset that with additional revenue to be able to provide deeper discounts for more Oregonians. So we need to use that tool that we already have to be able to charge a slight amount higher in some of our more popular, busier parks to be able to offset deeper discounts in some of those other parks and push some folks to redistribute across our system. Our park revenue is very critical to maintaining our service in our park system, so we're a little hesitant just to go give it all away. We want to keep it special. By granting us this flexibility to set fees a little higher for some campsites at some times, during the week versus the weekend, when it's raining like this, maybe it's much cheaper than it would be on a sunny July 4th weekend. But we'll be able to serve more people and be able to spread those benefits of a strong park visitation and a system for many years to come. So one thing we wanted to point out that really started driving this conversation, when you think about the camping side of our business, to think about how we could drive this a little bit differently. Our visitor numbers are up consistently, about 20%. There's that Memorial Day through Labor Day. Our prime season is up about 12%. That October through May season, it used to be called a shoulder season, it's up 45%. Wow. Oregonians are out a lot more than we do, like three seasons in 1 year. So we know that it's a good opportunity, but it's also a challenge to be able to run a system that wasn't designed for year-round service like we're providing now. We're serving more people, and it increases revenue in some places, but it doesn't distribute the revenue across the system the way that we believe that it could.
Those extra people translate into corresponding increases in operational maintenance costs, and we have managed the budget to cover those costs, but that's a shrinking curve as we look to try to cover some of those.
You need to say your name for the record.
Commissioner, Chair Clem, members of the committee, sorry for the record, M.G. Devereaux, Oregon State Parks.
Thank you.
The operational spending over time has not been able to keep pace with our ability to also maintain higher service levels and maintain that investment in our maintenance standards across the system. What we have done is to improve performance of the park system, making it as efficient as possible by dedicating funds to park improvement projects, some efficiency operations. But our utility costs are still increasing. The wear and tear on facilities and staff diminishes the park experience, and the uneven growth of the visitation across the system leaves others very crowded while others still under capacity. So what are our options? We can simply ignore the problem and hope that we come back to you at some point in time asking for a solution, but that will continue to allow the possibility that our facilities would decay under the high usage, or would also translate into higher increased costs for wholesale replacement of facilities. We believe that diminishes the quality of the experience. We believe it alienates some of our visitors and mostly our rural communities who would bear some of the implications of that when we've got systems that are overcrowding and overcapacity in those rural areas. We need not to ignore these problems, but to attract new people to those places that are underserved and be able to serve those places that have the high experiences with the best quality possible. We could also just limit access and by reducing capacity, charging higher fees across the board, but that would create a different imbalance in the system, rewarding a very few popular parks and compromising our ability to deliver services all the way across the system. We think that seems like a defeatist approach and unnecessary when we think we have other options. The system and your system of Oregon State Parks is very strong. People want to use it. People want to go to the coast. People want to go to Central Oregon. They want to visit those crown jewels like Silver Falls, like Fort Stevens, like Prineville Reservoir. Before we get to a crisis point, we'd like to bring you a realistic option that allows us to use this strength to deliver more state park experiences, especially to traditionally underserved groups. We can use data to identify opportunities for those slightly higher rates at key times, key places, or campsites that are always going to be worth a little bit more, and use this revenue to cut rates steeply in areas that we have extra capacity. We think that's good business, and we think that provides and fulfills our public mission. Because we can't predict 2 years in advance where or when we'd like to use this smart tool, which is the current budgeting system that we live under, from the limitation that's provided at the budget process, the rulemaking that goes with the current rate structure, we're asking for flexibility to make these decisions throughout the year. Acting through a public rulemaking process in the Oregon State Parks and Recreation Commission, which holds 5 public meetings a year all over the state, we remain responsive to public comments and needs. It is our intent to earn back the value of current waivers and discounts, that $1.6 million that Lisa mentioned earlier, each biennium, and funds beyond that limitation would naturally be subject to the legislative process through limitation.
We know that this doesn't solve all the long-term problems of stable funding for the aging park system that we are all going to be faced with. But it needs to serve a growing population and changing state. But it's a start. It frees us up to target and serve people new to the outdoor recreation. It gives us a better tool to drive the market to our rural parks, and it helps us balance some of our operational costs across the system. We're very mindful that our job is to provide equitable, affordable access to Oregonians and make sure that experience is meaningful. And that goal will dominate every decision that we make as we embark on this next journey for the agency if this bill would pass. We look forward to working with you as we cooperate to find a way to make our state park system stable for the future. And with that, I don't know if you want to take questions now, Chair Clem, or if you want to have Todd.
I'd like to have Todd go as well.
Okay.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Clem and Vice Chair Springer and McLean and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Todd Davidson, and I have the privilege and pleasure of serving as the director of the Oregon Tourism Commission. I'm here this morning to speak in support of House Bill 2318. No surprise to you, outdoor recreation is a vital part of Oregon's $10.8 billion tourism industry. Recent research indicates to us that over 25% of Oregon's visitors state that outdoor recreation is the impetus for them choosing to travel to Oregon over other destinations. And the recreational experiences that are shared with our visitors from across the U.S. and around the world are helping fuel the reputation of Oregon as a destination of choice. An Oregon system of state parks is a key component of our state's recreation story. The trails, the campsites, the recreation areas, and other amenities and attractions within their purview provide those venues and those environments for incomparable experiences and subsequently drives critical economic development in every corner of the state. And House Bill 2318 further unlocks this potential by enabling the Oregon Parks and Recreation Department to be more market-driven and market-responsive. The flex fee provisions that have been referred to this morning, established in House Bill 2318, mirror the supply and demand pricing relationship that is universal in the lodging sector of the broader travel and tourism industry. High demand would afford a lodging operator the opportunity to consider instituting a higher daily rate. Similarly, demand for occupancy can be influenced by instituting lower rates. Empowering our Parks Department to enact these principles will result in a structure of reasonable market-based rates that will both optimize revenue and drive demand for the entire system, including distributing visitors to currently underutilized, though no less amazing, parks and campgrounds across the state. In doing so, this model will not only augment the Parks Department revenue, but will infuse associated visitor spending into restaurants, gas stations, retail shops, and attractions in rural communities across Oregon. I applaud this committee, and I am grateful for your consideration of this bill early in this session, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have. Thank you very much.
Questions for this panel? Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So my first question is really the bill itself, and the pertinent language is on page one. I'm not sure if you have the bill in front of you. I'm looking at lines 14 through 19. So two questions on that. Number one, it looks like you can change fees no more than four times a year. Before I do my next question, why don't you address that? Because I'm seeing fees going all over the page multiple times.
So Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, yes, and the way that it's currently written, we would have the ability of only four times a year changing those rates. So what we're trying to avoid is every weekend changing the rate.
Follow up. So conceivably, we could have a person will experience a different rate two or three times, even four times, at the same campground in the same year. I'm trying to limit the changes. I can see maybe a good idea backfiring because the rate's always going up is the perception.
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Springer, that is a good idea to keep in mind. As Mr. Davidson said, one of the things that we face is that there are changing market rates across the system. And so while there is the opportunity that a visitor may experience a different rate at different times of the year, we believe that the visitor, certainly through our reservation system, when they're making those reservations, will have that information ahead of time, but will then choose those places that best fit their budget, which may then allow them to experience one of those underutilized places that they haven't seen before because that fits their budget in a different way.
Thank you. Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
Thank you. And so the next part of my question is, and I should probably preface this remark by saying I'm coming from a ways and means background, and so I see small agencies, you are not what I'm referring to, small agencies coming in and constantly asking for an increase or coming back to the legislature after the increase is enacted and want us to ratify it. So I'm trying to figure out if there's any cap here. And so as I read the language on line 16 and 17, fees assessed under this paragraph must be within the range of reasonable charges adopted by the commission under paragraph A of this subsection. So I go up to the paragraph A, and it also talks about reasonable charges. And I've heard the phrase market-based. So I'm trying to figure out, get a handle on what you're using to establish these rates and how large of an increase at one time could we potentially see.
Chair Clem, Representative Springer, the exact mechanism of that is based in our budget process on a market study that we do every 2 years. And consistently, Oregon Parks and Recreation sites come in at the lowest in the West, California, Washington, Nevada, Idaho. We would look through a rulemaking process to establish where that cap would be, and we would suggest through our commission that that cap is no more than 50% from that market rate upwards, but with the permission to go down all the way to 100% if we needed to.
Thank you.
Representative McEwen.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I appreciate Vice Chair Springer's question. I had the exact same question. That jumped out at me when it said four times a year. And I think you touched on it in your opening statement, but could you give me an example of how that would work? And the second question I have is, once again, I think to Representative Springer's comment, if I'm a consumer, I'm curious as to how many of your consumers are looking online to find those reservation opportunities versus how many people who are showing up and are going to be surprised by the change. So what is the consumer practice now? Is it basically web-driven so that they're shopping, or are they going to be surprised when they show up at the booth and find out that the prices are jacking around?
Chair Clem and Representative McEwen, so currently over 85% of our park visitors actually reserve 10 months in advance online.
Okay.
So it's very online-driven. They're very used to that. And they're planners.
Let me check. So is that visitors total, or is that people who are staying overnight visitors?
85% of our camping visitors.
Camping visitors. Yeah, I feel like there's probably a distinction where I might have the 15% who don't reserve online. But I'm guessing day visitors aren't going online because you can just drive up and see if the parking lot's got some space.
And Chair Clem, just to be clear, we are not anticipating looking at day use fees. This would be to focus on our camping.
The bill
rates
would allow it.
It would.
I notice.
It would allow it.
Yeah. I know it's not your plan, but we want to talk further about that. Vice Chair McLean.
You had a follow-up.
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Do you mind follow-up? Do you mind if she finishes up on the second question?
Yeah.
So, Chair Clem, Representative McEwen. So, example, I think, and if this isn't exactly where you were going, feel free to back me up.
You find shoulder season, main sea, up and down. So that four times a year, there's some rationale behind that. I'd love to hear it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we used to have this thing that we called discovery season, right? So we had prime season and the rates were this, and discovery season, we targeted it because people weren't coming that October through May. So we reduced the price all across the system. We didn't pick a park. So like Fort Stevens, for example, is up at 85% capacity almost year round. Humbug Mountain, probably less than 15% capacity. So we targeted that 45% the discovery fee. We reduced it, took it away 3 years ago, and we're at 45%. So it's that what time of the year, what weekend, what special events are going on, what is the market bearing? And it could be that all of a sudden we reduce those fees because in the spring there's some beach bill and some big festival going on that the prices could drive up. There's an eclipse happening.
Follow up.
So what I'm hearing you say is this is, you are moving into a new world where you are being very, very strategic and targeted about how you are managing this.
Chair Clem, Representative.
And this gives you the ability to do that.
We're really asking for the courage to change here and not run the state park system the same way we have run it for decades, to look at the opportunity to be able to use the camping side of the house, which is a strong strength to be able to carry the rest of the system and to be able to focus in on our backlog and maintenance and preserve the rest of the system.
Okay. Thank you.
And just to point out, I mean, these fees would be, I think we figured like $1.30 and some of the busier parks would be enough to be able to discount on the other side. I mean, this isn't like huge amounts of fee increases, but it resolves us coming back every time saying, may we please have another dollar fee increase?
One more follow-up, just and then I'll stop. In Section 1, Paragraph B, I think it may do this more than once in here, it changes the department to director. Why is that necessary? Reference to the department, it highlights the director.
Chair Clem, Representative McEwen, that's a nuance that came out of Legislative Council that, well, I'm not sure that we have a great answer to that, but we can certainly come back to you with what.
But a lawyer suggested it.
Buddy.
Okay.
Not us.
Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
My question was basically theirs, but as you spoke, then you confused me. So I'm just going. It's 8 o'clock, 8:30, quarter to nine. I'm just going to try and clear this up in my own mind. I am not one of your campers. Okay, so if I'm going to camp, I'm sorry, I'm not camping there. But I go a lot in the daytime. But I do have a lot of friends that do camp, and what you just said was that they reserve 10 months ahead.
Right.
And I'm assuming you're not changing the rate on them if they signed up and they're going to come 10 months later. They know know the rate when they sign up, and it's the same rate. So even though you're changing and you want to keep changing and you want to do it in a market-driven, targeted way, you're doing that on a yearly basis, looking at the year in a four-section program.
Chair Klein, Vice Chair McLean, you absolutely have it. So think about it from you've stayed in a hotel, right? When you reserve a year in advance, you pay that price. They don't call you back and say the price went up $200.
Sorry.
Once you're reserved and you're confirmed, that's your price. So this would be to entice more folks. If you want to come to this park, this is this price.
Right.
If you want to go to this park, it's buy one, get one free.
Okay, so you're going to have bargains,
mm-hmm.
right?
We want to try to entice. So this would also allow us to distribute folks across the system, like that Fort Stevens versus a Humbug Mountain or a Silver Falls versus a Cascadia. It gives us the opportunity to start distributing people into places that are very special, but they're underutilized.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Representative Beretta, who I don't think has talked yet this whole session, and then we'll come to Representative Espino.
I think he was giving them to Representative McEwen.
I only ask important questions. Thank you, Mr. Now, I had a question as far as underutilization. If you have parks that are what you'd maybe call continual losers, you know, they just never make it, what is your option for shutting those down so that they don't steal from others that are productive?
Chair Klein, Representative Barreto. So it's a difficult question because the calculation that we look at a state park property is more than just an economic calculation. We have places in the state that while they don't generate revenue, they are incredibly special from the resources that they protect or the history that they protect. And that's one of the reasons that we're asking for this flexibility, is that when you go into a small community that has a piece of property that is very dear to them but may not generate the amount of visitation or day use revenue or camping revenue that a park like Fort Stevens or Prineville looks at, and say to that community, we'd like to disinvest in this piece of property, that has significant implications for the identity and the character of that agency. And we believe you hear about those questions when we go to have that conversation. What we've tried to do were places that we have properties that may no longer have a mission fit. We are an offshoot of the Oregon Department of Transportation, and so some of our properties may have been waysides or may have been properties that were acquired for road development that are now just in parks, is look for other partners to help find the right fit for maintenance and management of that property, either through a volunteer organization, a local service club, or a local park and rec provider that piece of property may fit their mission better than the overall mission of the state park system.
Thank you. Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple things in here. One is that you spoke about underserved, or people, I guess that's people you want to entice to go. Is that correct? Well, who are those people, and why aren't we serving them now?
So, Chair Klem, Representative Esquivel, so, you know, Oregon's population is, the demographics are changing rapidly. I think Latino population is growing almost 60% in Oregon, right? So we're trying to figure out new ways to engage and relate to different communities that may want to come out and recreate differently, and trying to figure out what those barriers are to those recreations. Is it cost? Is it transportation? Is it that they're in rural areas? What can we do to entice the future generation of park lovers to be able to get out into our park system and actually enjoy it? And so those are the targets we're trying to do. It could be we have the vets program, we have the foster program, we have the adoptive program. There may be things that we could be doing with mental health. There are things that we could be doing with people with disabilities. I mean, there's all kinds of opportunities that we could be using this tool to attract new visitors to the system.
Follow up. Okay, I'd be careful there. The other thing is that I'm struggling with this, that you're telling me that the popular places are full, so we're going to raise the price there so people go to the unpopular places. I mean, I'm struggling with that. Why wouldn't I go there in the first place?
Chair Klein, Representative Esquivel, the price is only a piece of that conversation. We can offer the discounts today. The challenge when we offered the discounts today is that that's at the overall cost of service in the system. And so by giving us the flexibility to add an additional charge in some of those more popular places where we believe people will pay that to go to those other locations, it allows us the opportunity to make that revenue up in places that otherwise we would be taking a loss to the system that would further diminish our ability to maintain and manage those places. We do hope that there is a segment of the population that will see either the choice between the $2 or $3 at a place like Fort Stevens versus the lower costs at a place like Milo McIver or Humbug Mountain and make those value-conscious decisions on their revenue or on their vacation trips.
Representative, you want to keep exploring this for a little bit? Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you. Chair Clem, so my question is to Travel Oregon and what your thoughts are on this as a economic development tool. I mean, that's basically what we're doing is, you know, giving the department a little leeway on creating some economic development within their own system and really driving some campers into other areas. And I love you keep on mentioning Humbug Mountain, you know, in my district. So
he knows where it is.
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Brock Smith, you know, the part of the answer to your question is really enveloped a little bit in Representative Esquivel's question regarding, you know, how pricing can drive demand in different locations. As I referenced in my testimony, higher demand can afford you that opportunity to charge a slightly higher rate potentially. At the same time, you can influence demand by modifying prices. What happens a lot is, you know, at Travel Oregon, we're looking at how can we influence our potential visitors. These are people that have not chosen Oregon yet, but how do we touch them at every point in that decision-making process? And one of the places is price, because it's something that people, when they're searching, you know, look at how we may use one of the online travel agencies. You know, you may search by a brand that you're comfortable with, but you also will search by price. You have that ability to sort by price. You have that ability to select, you know, search only for those properties that may deliver a certain price. You can do the same when you're looking at parks. And so if there's this flex fee and you're searching by price, then you can start looking at, well, what are those places that are falling within that price structure? And these could be places that you wouldn't have considered before, but you're now being introduced to because that's what's showing up in your query. When you're sitting there online saying, I'm looking for a place I could go camping that's $20 a night, not $30 a night, just to pick an arbitrary number. That in and of itself can influence planning decisions and subsequently start to distribute folks around the state. So flex fee, to me, is really about, as I said, optimizing revenue while also affording you that opportunity to look at distributing visitors throughout the state and subsequently driving that economic development in rural parts of Oregon. We saw the article that just came out. I saw it yesterday in the Portland Business Journal and Oregon Business Magazine, that there are rural parts of the state that have not benefited from the economic recovery as much as other parts. And they talk specifically about, you know, which counties have not seen the recovery that other parts of the state has. While the state overall has recovered the job losses of the Great Recession, not every county in Oregon has. And, you know, here's an opportunity for us to continue to drive demand, to drive visitation to some other parts of the state and hopefully stimulate some job growth as well.
Thank you.
To follow up on that and to Representative Esquivel's question as well, you know, we would work closely with Travel Oregon and our business partners and travel partners to promote our parks that are underutilized. We know from the Seven Wonders campaign, Smith Rocks is completely utilized, and I mean, people are parking in Terrebonne and walking in. So if we can market, which is something we haven't done as a state agency, if we can market some of these underutilized parks and some of these gems that people don't even know are in their district or their backyard, it can help us redistribute those folks and drive price to be able to get them into a park that they may not have been aware of or might have a whole different experience in.
Do we have resident, non-resident rates?
We do not.
Chair Clem, we did try that experiment about 20 years ago, and the result was a fee arms race between neighboring states and some concern from the tourism committee, the tourism community, especially on the coast, about what that non-resident rate meant in terms of marketing ourselves to other people.
Sure. Other states do it for sure. I've experienced it. I know that it happens. Yeah. Just because we disarm doesn't mean Hawaii or Hawaii. I can't remember where, but somebody definitely irritated me when I no, I paid and went in because I was already there. What am I supposed to do? But
Tom. Yeah, I was just going to add, Chair Clem, that although I wasn't in this role, I have heard the legends of the in-state, out-of-state, resident, non-resident fee structure and the avalanche of outcry that we heard from visitors from out-of-state that basically said, we've got great parks here, or there are great parks over here. They don't do this kind of disparity. We're going to go there. And we actually saw decreasing demand and occupancy in state parks that year until it was subsequently reversed.
Well, the reason I mention it is when it's a flat rate, it's not such a big issue. But when you're going to differential rates, if you pick a place that is a very well-known, you know, maybe world-class destination, and if you pick a market rate that is appropriate for the demand there, and the people coming here by definition are tourists with money because they drove or flew here, and the people from Oregon who are driving in their, you know, staycation sort of mode, you're inherently now going to switch to higher prices in places where Oregonians used to go at a certain price, and it's going to be higher. So that's why I asked the question. If the goal is to try and tap the market, what I don't want to do is tap the market so hard that you, it's still full, but it's filled with a bunch of wealthy out-of-state people, while in-state people say, oh, I think I'm going to have to go to the other park because it's, you know, $20 difference. If we're talking a dollar, I don't think it matters. But if you're talking double to go to one and the other, I certainly look at hotels and say, I can't afford that one, don't want to stay in one that looks like it's a one-star, maybe somewhere in between. And that's what, you know, I think you'll eventually get if people really are just browsing online and don't really know anything about the parks. They may pick the middle point. Mm-hmm. Vice Chair Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More of a process question. I see we're under public hearing. Do we have anybody signed up to testify?
Bill Perry. Not against it. Did you say
or
against?
Or do we have anybody signed up to
Bill
testify against it or for this bill?
Bill Perry is our Billy Perry is our only other witness, and he wants it all to himself. I think I saw body block four people trying to sign up. So, any more questions for these, and then we can hear from the
Mr. Chairman,
Representative Witt.
Campgrounds Trivago.
Is that the name of the
Park Vago?
I don't know. It's in
okay. All right. I think we're okay for now. What questions, Mr. Perry? Can you just take the whole thing there?
Thank you.
You just stretch out a little bit if you want. Put a jacket on one. Yeah, could you help him out, please? We've got the whole thing, so whatever you want to do there.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Bill Perry with the Oregon Restaurant Lodging Association, and I'll be brief. We're supportive of the bill. There are different things in, I think the parks have grown in demand over the couple of years, and that you always can't plan for those. There's many of you have owned businesses, you know, costs go up from time to time, and there just needs to be able to be an adjustment because we need to make sure that the customers that do come have a good experience, and we need to make sure that they come back because it is beneficial, and it is one of the few programs we have that spread people outside of the state instead of just the urban areas. So we want to make sure that our parks have the ability to make sure that the customers are served well. And I will say that the Parks Department, and in my time since I've been at the Restaurant Lodging Association, they've been on different committees of ours. They've been involved in our conventions and stuff, so they've been very accessible. I find them very easy to work with. And, you know, if there is a concern, they still do come in front of the Legislative Fiscal Office, in front of Ways and Means process. So, you know, if they get out of whack, it's not like you don't have checks and balances to do it. So I find them very accessible. I think the parks are good. They've been a driving force in tourism. So we want to make sure that the customers can be serviced well and stay happy. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for Bill? Okay.
And I did not harm anybody signing up for testimony.
It was just more like a shield. It wasn't like a really an elbow. It was just like a... Okay. Anybody else here on 2318? I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2318. I'm going to open public hearings on House Bill 2297 and 2241. And why don't we start with Mike? Nope. Okay. Raquel. Lori and Mike.
Good morning, and thank you. For the record, I'm Lori Onan. I work for Governor Kate Brown in our Natural Resources office. And I'm really very pleased to be here today. I just have a few brief remarks before I hand it off to Mike and then to Raquel. I'm just very happy that Chair Clem and members of the committee that you are continuing the discussion on this very, very important issue for Oregon's future. Water is everything to Oregon. It's our lifeblood for so many things. And so, again, really want to thank you for having this conversation. It may be hard to feel the urgency around drought right now with the intense and severe winter snow, rain, and storms. But, you know, we know from experience that drought is a significant problem for Oregon. Eastern Oregon obviously has had drought conditions for many years, even while the other parts of the state have not had. But in 2015, if people can remember, Oregon saw record-breaking high temperatures, lack of snowpack, and low stream flows. And in our small and rural communities in particular, and we saw this in southern Oregon, we saw this in the Willamette Valley, there were communities that really could not remember seeing the conditions as they saw them that year. And there were a lot of folks that were very worried about running out of water for their customers, and there were other challenges. So it really was a wake-up call that we're not as prepared as we need to be. And so as a result, the Drought Task Force was convened. And Raquel will talk more in more detail about the task force and also about the bills and the amendments before you today. But I just wanted to highlight the importance of continuing to address this going forward. The impacts of drought are far-reaching and long-lasting, and we need as many tools in our toolbox as we can to address both in-stream needs, the needs of our fish and wildlife, and out-of-stream water needs, the needs of agriculture, the needs of our communities, the needs of industry. So I'll stop and turn it over to Mike, but I just also wanted to say thank you to the members of the Drought Task Force. There are some folks in the room here today, and to Water Resources Department for their great support of the task force. It will be very important to keep working on the numerous recommendations the task force had going forward and following up on that as resources allow. So we will stay engaged in that. Thank you.
And someone needs to start by telling us why we have two bills that look almost identical to each other. I see there's a word difference, but for the benefit of everybody else.
And there's amendments to only one.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Raquel Ransier, Senior Policy Coordinator. So we had a little history here, and then we'll come back to you. This task force was doing their work between July and October. As you all know, the executive branch, our bills were due much in advance of that. As a result of that, we filed placeholder bills. So the governor's office has House Bill 2241, which is a placeholder bill, as well as House Bill 2297. That was the department's placeholder bill. And as a result, we were still talking about potential amendments to bring forward to continue this conversation. And we ended up with two in one bill and none in the other. But they have different relating to clauses, same concept, though. So it does give us the opportunity to have more flexibility in talking about these issues today. So we'll have two proposals that we'll discuss in more detail. And I suspect that there may be people in the audience audience that want to talk about some of the other drought task force recommendations. So this preserves the opportunity to have the conversation, and certainly we know it's confusing. So.
Okay, sorry, go ahead.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, my name is Mike Harriman. I'm the state resilience officer. I've been in the position since May of last year when I was confirmed by the full Senate. The position was sprang out of a task force. In 2013, the Oregon Seismic Safety and Policy Advisory Committee introduced the 50-year plan on the called the Oregon Resiliency Plan to the 77th Legislative Assembly. This 50-year plan was pretty overwhelming. So at the time, the Committee for Veterans and Emergency Preparedness, both House and Senate, recommended a task force to break it down into a biennial, come back and give us some things to chew on over a two-year period. This position that I'm sitting in is a direct result of that and some other things that came out of that. I'd like to refer you to this because if you're not aware of the Oregon Resiliency Plan, I would be glad to spend some time with you offline and go over it. But Chapter 8 specifically talks about water and wastewater systems. So the hazard we're here today to talk about is drought, but the resource is water. And as Lori talked about, it impacts us in so many ways. And so there are connections between drought, other hazards, wildland fires, communicable diseases, but the main thing is to prepare Oregon for a really catastrophic event called the Cascadia Subduction Zone. I think that this is this task force needs to complete its task and also come back with some recommendations around water security and the interconnections of those lifelines from where the water is stored at and how they come down to the drinking fountain, to fire hydrants, to agricultural issues. The key on this is the task force, I think, would be very beneficial to complete its task and come back with some recommendations. But it also will impact other communities. One of the amendments in there talks about mitigation planning at the rural communities. This is something lacking in almost all city and county jurisdictions is planning for mitigation events. And anytime we can put money at the local level to do mitigation planning, it helps them bring their networks together to do with, to talk to their stakeholders and identify those critical resources that they need. So when a bad day happens in the case of a drought that we'll see coming versus an earthquake where it'll happen and we'll have a no notice event. I would just like to close in summary. I can answer any questions for you, but I think this task force is extremely important. I think it's going to add benefits, long-lasting, than just what's going the end of the task force, that will then be able to be connected to other activities going on in the state for resiliency. So thank you very much.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, again, Raquel Rancier, Senior Policy Coordinator for the Oregon Water Resources Department. So today, thank you, Representative Clem, or Chair Clem, for giving us the opportunity to have the discussion around drought. As you can see, there's lots more discussions to be had around this topic. I'll note that the Dash 1 amendments, certainly we'll hear some more feedback, I think, today, and we welcome to having more conversations with stakeholders about how to adjust those bills. So this is, I think, today a conversation starter, particularly on that Dash 1 amendment. With that in mind, a little history here. As I noted, the task force met back in 2016 from July to October. They submitted their final report to the legislature. At that time, it was actually the House Land Use, House Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee that had heard the report. And so there's recommendations included in my written testimony. There's a link to the full report there if you'd like to look at what else the task force recommended. So with that, I did note that the two bills that are here today, they were placeholders, so they're ready for gut and stuff. If there are any proposals that folks would like to bring forward during this session to move forward the recommendations of the Drought Task Force. We have brought forward two proposals to discuss. There's the Dash 1 amendments, I should note that we were limited in terms of what we could propose, in part because we needed to make sure any new proposals that we bring forward are consistent with the governor's recommended budget. So The two proposals we're talking about today are within our base budget, and they're also consistent with the governor's recommended budget. With that in mind, I'll talk a little bit about the Dash 1 amendment. The Dash 1 amendment is a concept around planning. So if you see the Drought Task Force recommendation around planning, it's recommendation F in the report. We spent a lot of time in the Drought Task Force looking at literature on best practices around how you respond to drought. And if you look at the literature, what it really says, and this really is consistent with what Mike just said, is that you want to plan in advance for it. And if you can, try to mitigate the impacts in advance, because if you're in response mode, then really it's harder to prevent some of the impacts that you'll see. So with that in mind, in 2015, we did see impacts in communities on the western side of the state, so the side of the state that is not very used to dealing with drought. And that's in part because there was less time spent planning around it and creating that resiliency to prevent those impacts. So in particular, where we saw the most challenges was for these smaller water systems, where they already have challenges with potentially having volunteer staff and meeting basic regulatory requirements. So there was a lot of conversation about that in the Drought Task Force. And with that in mind, one of the recommendations was around funding for drought planning. So this Dash 1 amendment does we have an existing program. It's our feasibility study grants program, or some people know it as our water conservation, reuse, and storage grant program, or 1069. There's lots of Senate Bill 1069 grants. And that program currently can fund the planning studies for assessing the feasibility of developing a water conservation, reuse, or storage project. So as a result of that, we're trying to just add an additional provision that fund can provide money for, and that is funding for drought planning. So this would help communities. So there's really four provisions that we've outlined. I think there's a need for continued discussions if this is the right fit or not based on the recommendations of the Drought Task Force. But funding for small water systems, less than 10,000 in population, to do water management and conservation plans. So what we found is that some small water systems didn't know what their water rights were because they hadn't been in drought before. And so knowing what your water rights are, knowing where you are in the priority system is very important. And then being able to identify, well, what's the vulnerabilities? So for some of these small water systems, they may have actually been junior, and it's just they hadn't been regulated before because we hadn't had such a severe drought. And so getting them to at least assess and understand what their water rights are, and then being able to find what those potential vulnerabilities are, and then taking the next step of, well, what can they do to conserve water, as well as what can they do if they do find themselves in the situation where they have insufficient supplies, to be ready for potential curtailment actions and being able to implement that in a structured way. So we also have a proposal within there to be able to fund water management and conservation plans for agricultural produce or irrigation districts and water control districts. Not all districts are required to develop plans, and so this would provide an incentive. In addition, funding for regional drought planning. We heard from one individual that testified at the Drought Task Force that their community left federal dollars on the table because they couldn't come up with enough cost match on their end to be able to obtain all the federal funding to do drought contingency planning. So Bureau of Reclamation, they actually have a drought contingency planning program, and that's also because at the federal level, if you look at FEMA, if you look at Bureau of Reclamation, they've started trying to put more of a focus on this, let's be prepared for drought, instead of trying to just focus on response actions that tend to be who knows how effective they're going to be based on what the response is needed. So the fourth component then is being able to fund plans to mitigate drought impacts. So with that in mind, that hopefully gives some of the context behind this and what's included in this bill. I'll note again that I think that there's more conversations to be had. I've heard we need to talk about the existing program has a cap of $500,000. We think that's too high. That's in this amendment. And so that needs to be discussed of what the appropriate level is in terms of a cap for an individual grant. I think there needs to be more conversations around the water management conservation plans. And then also I've heard some comments around small water systems and their challenge in being able to even do a 50-50 cost share, which is included is the regular part of this program and continues forward in this proposal. So I think there's more conversations to be had, but I think the important thing is that we do need to continue to have conversations about how we can help communities be more prepared for drought, how we can address the impacts in vulnerable systems both. And we, when we talk about that, drought impacts are broad. They can be from the recreation community. They can be from agriculture, cities, other in-stream needs, fish and wildlife. So drought really does have widespread impacts. So that's the first concept. The second one, the Dash 2 amendments, this one is one that we've actually been talking about at the department since probably midsummer last year. And so I'll note that I think in my written testimony, I probably downplayed how much this could be tied to recommendations of the Drought Task Force. And looking at the recommendations of the Drought Task Force again last night, if you look at recommendation A, there is a recommendation around expanding data and some sub-recommendations in there about implementing funding for data. So it's probably up to interpretation how closely tied this one is to the Drought Task Force. With that, though, what this amendment does is we currently, in 2001, there was a program established for us to be able to partner with water right holders to be able to provide a cost share in funding the installation of measuring devices on surface water diversions. So it's a voluntary program really to be able to help communities in areas where it was in the interest of the state as well as I think the water users to be able to get those measuring devices installed. So this proposal proposes to actually add groundwater users as an eligible entity to benefit from this program. When the bill was originally written, it didn't include groundwater. As many of you probably have been following, there are areas of the state where we do have concerns over groundwater and declining groundwater levels. And water use measurement, in particular in some of those areas, we use that data when we're doing what's called a groundwater basin study. And that helps us understand how much water is available for withdrawal. And it's actually really important to helping us manage those water supplies for existing users into the future. So this is an opportunity for us to be able to provide some, again, this is the non-regulatory side. This is the going to water right holders and being able to assist them with these, regardless of whether or not it's required under the law. So with that, I think I'll pause and see if there are questions.
Vice Chair McClain.
Oh, well, first of all, this area is so important, and I appreciate the fact that I have not read the drought report, and so I will do that. I guess it was in the other committee, and so I just haven't had it on my reading list yet, but I'll do it. I do have a conservation bill that's coming up this year that I'm working with fabulous folks from homeowner associations, the League of Cities, and also other folks that are, you know, really trying to figure out how to encourage, you know, like low water type landscaping, because I think we have to really start spreading, as you point out, to a wide variety of ways and methods and tactics on how we use less water, protect our water, and, as you say, have a plan A, B, or C if we have a drought scenario. And so, very big deal. dash ones and dash twos and bills that can be gut and stuffed, you know, I guess I haven't taken, I don't have enough details to know if I think your ideas are good or bad or indifferent, but it's a situation where I think that the main message you give today is that drought is real and that we have parts of our state who have been dealing with it in spades for years and that we need to get serious about it. We need to continue to carry on any good effort we can to integrate our services and our service providers and folks who use the resource. And I know I went to a fabulous, I don't know who was the basic host, but it was all water providers and people who care about water, and they had a really nice briefing, and I see some of them in the audience, so that maybe they're going to speak to it. Yeah, but well, it's really important for, I think, all of us to continue to support the governor and to support the agency and to really make sure the legislature understands this is for the long run. We've got a lot of work to do, and there was some senator the other night that said, you know, whiskey's for drinking and water's for fighting. And I think that we need to make sure that we're ready to just get in and roll up our sleeves and keep working. And I agree with you. When I talk about drought, you know, to folks at home, they look at me. But I said, it's coming. You know, got to be prepared.
Okay. I represent Brock Smith, and we got a long list of people here to testify.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's okay. Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Clem. So for those who are watching, because I know that my folks down in Harbor Water District are probably watching this very closely. They could be watching it right now. So to put it in perspective, how would these bills with the amendments, just a little backstory, Harbor Water receives its water from the Chetco River. Their intake is about 2.5 miles, I think, upstream. And because of the low flow towards the end of the summer months, they start taking in brackish water, if you will, with salt, you know, salt intrusion, which causes a serious problem within the whole infrastructure. And folks are, and business communities and water heaters and ice makers and all of the above are, you know, having serious problems. How will this, just real quick, benefit them?
Chair Clem, Representative, that's a great question, and I think I'd hate to say it, but I think that they're one of the ones that informed this process from the standpoint of recognizing again that if we can plan ahead and identify where there's risks in a system and vulnerabilities, that such as this water intake that you're referring to, if we can do that planning piece up front and identify where those vulnerabilities are, then before a drought occurs, so before they experience these significant low flows with the high tides where they had those challenges, that perhaps we could then take actions so that we could fix the issue before those low flows occur again. So from that standpoint, it's this is the proactive piece. They've already identified the challenge. Certainly, if they wanted to do a planning process to see if there's other vulnerabilities in their systems, that may be an opportunity for them to get assistance through this.
We'll talk offline.
Yep. Okay, great. Thank you all for you look like you want
Chair
to say Clem, something.
Chair Clem, may I add one thing? So I'll note that the Dash 2 amendments, when they came back from LC, they said they're outside of the House Bill 2297 relating to drought, relating to clause. And so I'll note, since everybody's in the room here, and since to reduce confusion, that there is 2241, which it may, with some changes to the language, be able to fit into. However, earlier in the session, you may recall that you actually approved drafting of this, and so there's an LC that I think just came back for the Dash 2s where it could be introduced as a new bill. So there's, I guess the point being is if people do like that idea, there is a concept that it can move forward in.
I think I have some other relating to just water floating around, too, somewhere. Or if I don't, I have it in the hopper.
Yes.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you. Let's get into our witnesses. April Snell, Jeff Stone, Marianne Nash. I'm going to start us off. On deck, Kimberly Priestley, Tom Wolf, and Then we'll probably do Mark Landauer and Tracy together. Okay. What is it? Water Avengers? Water Warriors? What is it? Water. You have some name for yourselves sometimes.
Not publicly.
Oh. Could you just delete, just rewind and, no? Okay. Sorry. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Klim, Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair McLean, members of the committee, thank you very much for your time. April Snell, Executive Director with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. We are the association that represents irrigated agriculture in the state. My members are irrigation district, water control districts, and similar entities who collectively deliver to one-third of all the irrigated land in the state. The rest of that is served by individual irrigators and farmers, and of course with rain and other things that we get a lot more on the west side. So I am here to testify on House Bill 2241 and House Bill 2297, which you just heard the overview from the Raquel and that fine panel that preceded us. And I did serve on the governor's drought task force that you just heard about, and do encourage you to read that report. There's a nice short executive summary that has the recommendations that we came out of there. And we had a very short time frame in which to come up with ideas and reach consensus on those. So, frankly, there is a lot more conversations to be had. And in the back of that report, you'll find an appendix that has all the ideas that we did not reach consensus on, either because we did not have time or simply because of the interests at the table. We just weren't able to move beyond some differences. So, as was mentioned, it's raining now, and people may be thinking, well, we're not in a drought. But what you're seeing here is actually a product of the cycle of drought, and some of the landslides and other things that we're facing are because we had a number of years of very dry conditions. And it takes a long time for not only streams to repair, but also the reservoirs that my folks use to aggregate, to irrigate food and other important agricultural products. So there is a need for some continued discussion around drought and around the recommendations and the other ideas that are in that report. We also are supportive of seeing some funding for additional drought planning and feasibility. It was mentioned briefly, we have a member just here a little east of us, Saniam Water Control District. They received a grant from the Bureau of Reclamation to do an extensive drought plan. The total project cost is just shy of $400,000 just for that one district and the entities that they're working with, just to give you a flavor of that. And it is something that we would like to see some additional funding for supporting cost share programs and addressing the groundwater issues that we have in this state, as well as surface water. However, I think there's some on both of the amendments that you have, there is some need for some further conversations and clarifications, as Ms. Rensier mentioned earlier. And so we'd encourage you to continue that conversation. And I think it's something that, while I'm up here on behalf of the irrigation districts and in irrigated agriculture, drought is something that impacts all of us, and it's something that we have to work together with agriculture, municipal, and conservation interests at the same table, working out our differences and coming out with something that works. Because fundamentally, in a time of drought, you can't make it rain, you can't create more water. You have to work with what you have and find ways to ensure that those folks who really need it, and in those times, whether that's a city or a farmer or the fish and stream, that we find a way to make it work. And there will be another drought. I hope it's not as severe as the ones we've had in the past, but it will happen again, and we need to get ahead of that curve as a state. So thank you very much for your time.
Great.
Chair Klim, Vice Chair Springer and McLean, Jeff Stone. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. You have testimony in front of you that I will not repeat, but just give you a couple highlights. First of all, the nursery industry is a very water-dependent industry, and 2015 was a clear wake-up call about the very many challenges that face us on drought. That time, we were talking about coping with the drought, not so much what are the plans that we can put in place, what tools do we need in order to prevent that type of structural problem in the future. I'll get right to the two amendments. First of all, the 1069 funds, when it was created, is the language that you have before you is one that fits within the construct of how feasibility funds should be used. Keep in mind, though, that 1069 was for projects and for things of that nature. So you're authorizing an expanded use of 1069 funds. Now, we don't have a philosophical problem with that, but just know that we need to prioritize in order to get what the true purpose of that fund is, to try to get projects done. The second, regarding measurement, is far more complex and I think deserves a greater consideration by this body on the totality of how you measure. Cost sharing was one during the Drought Task Force, which the OAN was a part of. We looked at barriers that keep folks from doing measurement. The cost, especially with limited fiscal resources, was one of those to those landowners. So some type of cost share element is something worth your consideration. But I would urge caution with this bill that I think that there are bigger, more complex conversations that we need to have with you, with the conservation community, about measurement itself. So I'll conclude my comments there.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Marianne Nash, here today for the Oregon Farm Bureau. We represent over 6,000 family farmers and ranchers throughout the state. Jeff mentioned the importance of water to the nursery industry. I will relay that water is the lifeblood of all of Oregon agriculture. We are top in the state for a number of commodities, and in order for us to continue to maintain our tremendous value to the state as the second largest economic driver, we need to ensure that we're taking water supply very seriously and making sure that we have water to meet all of Oregonians' needs, including our need for a healthy, sustainable, and reliable source of food. So we are here to certainly support the work of the Drought Task Force. We are members of the work of the Drought Task Force, and I think a lot of good discussions happened there. I think these are two very worthwhile concepts, and I will echo the comments of my fellow panelists in that I do think we need to make sure that we are understanding all of the implications of where we're spending our resources, making sure we're spending our resources the most effectively, and also making sure as we're looking toward, for example, supporting increased investment in measurement, that that is being done in a way that the department can actually utilize the data. It's actually making sense for and not imposing additional cost burdens on farmers. And so I guess to even be more direct to the point that I think Jeff kind of mentioned, we have big concerns with some of the measurement concepts that are coming out this session, but certainly support the focus of measurement and investment in measurement here, as the department is currently focusing on its priority areas, investing money where it most needs the data and most needs the resources, and doing it within its existing constructs and existing law. I think to me that's the only way that we will actually be able to work with the department to ensure the department is utilizing the data and able to actually get a picture of what's going on of water in the state, as opposed to just getting data for data's sake. So with that, I will conclude. Any questions?
Questions for this group? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marianne already told us how important water is and how important agriculture in general is to our state's economy. I'm wondering if Jeff could perhaps remind us how important his industry is to our state's economy so that we better understand what's at risk here.
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, you're breaking my streak of not mentioning and being a total honk for my industry. Mm-hmm. The nursery and greenhouse industry is the second largest agricultural sector in the state, $952 million now. We're almost back up to $1 billion after the economic plight in 2008. We're also the third largest nursery state. We're really second. Florida counts citrus. That's cheating. It's not a nursery product, but we'll take number three. We are a significant user of water, and we've actually made great gains in becoming more efficient with our production type. So thank you for the question. The nursery industry is a large one, but we work with all of our agriculture and conservation folks to try to get at some of these joint issues.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions? Okay, I'm going to ask, I assume everybody in the task force is anti-drought. That's a consensus point.
Chair.
Yeah.
Okay. Chair Clinton, yes.
Okay, thank you. That's it for now. Can I call Kimberly Priestley and Tom Wolf up?
Good
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kimberly Priestley, and I'm here representing Water Watch of Oregon. Water Watch is a river conservation group that works across the state to protect and restore flows. Before I speak to the amendments in particular, just by way of background, Water Watch was a member of the Drought Task Force. We were also a member of, or we were part of a small group that helped to craft Senate Bill 1069 in 2008. We also were part of a larger group that helped to craft 839 in 2013, and also were very involved in the development of the Integrated Water Resources Strategy that the Commission adopted in 2012. All of these forums and all of these, you know, the resulting laws and documents that came out of these processes all have one thing in common, which is to promote the development of in-stream and, or to promote meeting needs of both in-stream and out-of-stream needs into the future. So there has been sort of a long history of moving, of the state sort of embracing, addressing both in-stream and out-of-stream needs. As to, you know, I wanted to start my testimony by saying that Water Watch is very much in support of furthering the discussion on drought. It is a critical issue for this state. We are very supportive of advancing planning for drought, and we are supportive of funding drought measures for planning, but and also projects across all spectrums, both, you know, farms, cities, fish and wildlife. That said, we do have some concerns with the Dash 1 amendments as proposed. And, you know, I will preface that by saying we're heartened by the testimony today that people are open to discussion. So I'll just note these with the understanding that it sounds like we will be having more discussions. First of all, we do not believe that the Dash 1 amendments are consistent with the underlying purpose of the Conservation, Reuse, and Storage Fund. This fund was narrowly crafted to help with feasibility funding for conservation, reuse, and storage. And while we support funding for drought planning, we are concerned about opening up this particular pot. You know, I will note that in terms of the conversations of the Drought Task Force, what was recommended was a new fund. We never at any point discussed opening up existing funds, which I think is a key point. And again, we would support a new fund for this purpose. I would also note that the Drought Task Force, there were a number of recommendations in the Drought Task Force report, and there was no prioritization of which measures, you know, if there was a limited pot of money, which measures we would support. So I just want to make sure that the committee was aware that these four bullet points in the Dash 1.
Particular order.
Right. And it's not just that they don't go in any particular order, but they're one of many. There are many other recommendations that require funding that did not make it into this list. And so that leads to our second concern, which is as I noted, the state has been moving forward to try and address both in-stream and out-of-stream needs, and you know we would like to see that theme continue. And in this bill in particular, I think outwardly it appears that it's more focused on addressing out-of-stream needs. And so as we move forward in discussions, we would ask that we increase the focus on in-stream, or at least balance out in-stream. And in our comments, I have suggested some changes. Some of the changes are, you know, just simply adding the word in-stream and out-of-stream so that it's clear that when we're talking about drought planning, we're talking about both in-stream and out-of-stream. And other changes are recommending adding to the list of activities that could be funded if we went forward and expanded this fund, which again we have concerns with, but also adding some of the recommendations that would benefit in-stream interests in particular. So I guess, you know, in conclusion, again, I just want to reiterate that Water Watch is very supportive of funding drought planning and drought mitigation measures for all sectors. We just have concerns about the Dash 1 as is. And with that, I will take any questions.
You want to go, and then we'll come back to
Chair Clem, committee members. For the record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm here representing Trout Unlimited, the world, not the world, but the nation's largest conservation, cold water conservation group. And who knows, maybe the world.
Yeah, you say it. I mean, I would try.
Yeah, so I just want to put a face on that because it's easy for it to say this. Trout Unlimited is a group of both a mixture of national staff and volunteers we have, and both Democrats and Republicans who are concerned about watersheds. Specifically, as we started out, we were concerned about so that we could catch bigger trout, but it's moved way past that, and we're concerned about the impact that there is on watersheds, not only for fish and wildlife, but for drinking water, for use in farms and other things. And we're very concerned. We work very hard. I'm not saying that we don't get involved in lawsuits, but we're, for the most part, very non-litigious, and we work primarily both with staff and volunteers working with private landowners to look at ways that we can come up with common sense solutions. And it's a very big part of our mission. And it's, you know, in the 25 years that I've been with TU down here in Salem, I've seen us grow from a membership, national membership of 20,000 and a state membership of 300 to a national membership of 155,000 and 3,200 here in state with that mission in mind. Having said that, and boasted about how great a group Trout Unlimited is, I just, in purely pride on my part, I just want to share that Trout Unlimited also supports what happened in the Drought Task Force. We did not participate in that because, frankly, we didn't have anybody either in staff or myself, and my excuse was I spent all summer and fall fishing, hunting, and backpacking, so that was my excuse. And one of our staff had a baby, that was her excuse. So I think we had good excuses why we weren't there, but we followed it closely. We like what came out of that, and we, for the most part, and we're willing to work with the other groups, both farming, nursery, everybody, and the Water Resources Department to come up with a commonplace solution. But we do have a couple objections to HB 2297 and the -1 amendments. The concern is the scope of projects to receive funding pursuant to the Water Conservation Reuse and Storage Program. First of all, TU is concerned that the proposed language does not expressly require that the drought plans consider the needs of in-stream water users in addition to out-of-stream appropriators. So TU agrees that drought conditions have and will continue to impact Oregon's wild water supplies, and that proper planning is key to avoiding or mitigating these impacts. However, drought impacts extend to fish and wildlife resources, and these resources require sufficient quantity and quality of water to complete their essential life functions. Additionally, the Dean Runyon did a survey for ODFW back in 2008 and discovered in 2008 dollars that $2.5 billion comes into the Oregon economy every year to people that hunt, fish, and view wildlife. And now with, you know, better economy and rise in inflation, is that money is easily over $3 billion that comes in. And I think it's important for the people that run hotels, that run restaurants in rural communities, that are guides, that we make sure for their economic need in those rural communities that they have be sufficient water in the streams so that people continue to hunt, fish, and view wildlife. So therefore, if the legislator does choose to fund drought planning, TU requests that the language specifically state that the needs of aquatic and riparian species must be given equal consideration to out-of-stream uses in any drought management plan that is seeking funding pursuant to the proposed provisions. And further and finally, if the scope of eligible projects is expanded to include new projects such as water management and conservation plans, it should also include projects to seek to understand or meet in-stream needs especially during times of drought. Such efforts could include funds to complete in-stream flow studies or water acquisition and transfer projects that aim to secure more water in-stream for fish and wildlife resources. Doing so will help ensure that a balanced portfolio of drought management projects move forward in Oregon. I've sent in an electronic copy of my testimony. You can read for more detailed. Again, we are willing to work with Water Resources Department, with other user groups, to come up with commonplace, common sense solutions. And I just want to end with a little bit of philosophy, hopefully that shares what TU believes in and definitely what I believe in. Henry IV of France was the king who ended the religious wars that decimated France in the end of the 1500s, and he made France the most religious tolerant country in Europe at the time. And he once said, "Those who unswervingly follow their conscience are of my religion, and those, and I am of the religion of those, all those who are brave and good." And that's a philosophy that I hold to, that TU holds to, that we're willing to work with all water users, all farm groups, everybody, to come up with a commonplace solution to deal with the complex problem of drought. Thank you.
Okay, any questions for these two? Our Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think our panel members here represent a very reasoned and responsible approach, not only to this issue, but many, many, many issues that have come before this committee in the past. And I think theirs is a call, once again, for a balanced approach. And I'm curious whether they will be offering an amendment to that effect.
Yes, we will. But we're still in discussion stage on it. So, but we have a coalition of different groups besides just the two of us. I mean, Chair Clem, Representative Witt. So,
thank you very much.
Okay, we've got two more. Thank you. Two more witnesses or testifiers: Mark Landauer and Tracy Rutten.
Good morning, Chair Clem, members of the committee. My name is Mark Landauer. I'm here on behalf of the Special Districts Association and the Oregon Association of Water Utilities. We represent community and municipal water suppliers, and according to the Oregon Water Resource or the Oregon Health Authority and the Oregon Integrated Water Resources Strategy, more than 3,500 public water systems exist in the state of Oregon, and they serve approximately 88% of Oregon's population. That's about 3.3 million people. 55 of these public water systems serve 67% of the state's population. So that shows you that the vast majority of public water systems are actually very small. It should also be noted that municipal and community water suppliers withdraw only 6% of the total out-of-stream water. With that being said, I'd like to focus my comments to the Dash 1 amendment. I'm going to repeat something that has been said a couple times. I am a little bit concerned about the amount of money, the maximum grant amount under this proposal. I do understand that drought contingency plans can be rather expensive, but as was said earlier, this fund was set up largely for bricks and mortar type projects to undertake feasibility studies for reuse, conservation, and storage. So if you can imagine, a $500,000 grant is awarded. This fund has historically been funded at about $2 million a biennium. You're taking a good chunk of that money out from other worthy projects. So ideally, this funding might come from another program, but with the funding constraints, I understand why the department did this. The other challenge is the dollar-for-dollar match. As I stated earlier, there are a lot of very small community water systems. Those oftentimes are the ones that need the type of planning that is really critical to get through a low water year. As a result of their inability to come up with a dollar-for-dollar match, they're effectively shut out of this program. So my hope is that we can have further discussions and look at the size of many of these smaller systems to be able to get access to funds to do the type of planning that really is critical for many of the smaller ones. Rep. Smith mentioned Harbor Water District, a fairly small one, but that's actually a fairly large one when you look at many of the other ones. Approximately 3,000 of those communities' water systems serve less than 1,000 people. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks and look forward to additional conversations. Thank you.
Yeah, we'd rather hear from Tracy anyway. Tracy, please.
Chair Clem, members of the committee, for the record, Tracy Rutten, League of Oregon Cities, here today on behalf of Oregon's 241 cities, many who provide drinking water to their citizens. I want to testify conceptually in support of the Dash 1 amendments. I agree with much of what has already been said and share some of the similar concerns and questions that folks have already indicated about how we're going to go about funding for drought contingency planning, as well as voluntary drought or water management conservation plans, which have been an effective tool for many of our communities. For those not familiar with water management conservation plans, they are required for a number of our cities to adopt and can be very effective tools for better managing their limited resources. I also want to note that within there's conservation elements and then there's curtailment elements. And there's a big difference between conservation and curtailment. We have many of our water providers engaged in ongoing conservation practices and have found those to be very effective for managing limited resources. Curtailment is something we absolutely want to avoid as communities. It is not good for economic development. It's not good for public health or public safety. Curtailment means that we're running out of water. It means that we're seeing levels and triggers within our water supply system that would indicate that we have a real problem on our hands. So I've seen in several instances where those two terms get used interchangeably, so I want to make sure to clarify that part of it. The other thing that we have noted is the inequities, not sure that's the exact right term, but that our larger water systems have a lot more resource, which is not likely to be surprising to you all. But for those smaller communities, they really do struggle to be able to engage effectively in conservation practices. We did a survey at the League of Oregon Cities in 2015, just prior to the drought really hitting, which found a majority of our communities, of our cities, are doing ongoing conservation. For those that indicated they were not doing that regularly, they were our smaller cities, which is obviously not surprising, but just demonstrates the challenges that those smaller cities have with the resource, with the staffing, with the expertise to be able to get ahead of some of these issues. Again, a lot of our cities have been doing, I think, conservation before it became kind of the cool buzzword that it is now or that it becomes during a drought. We've seen a lot of effective programs with rebates for low-flow showerheads, with smart metering in the city of Bend. They can detect leaks right away within their system, and they can contact consumers within 24 hours and say, we've seen something on your water system, we think there could be a leak there, and they detect that and repair it. So there's been a lot of effective practices. We want to make sure that smaller communities can also engage in some of those, and I think that this is an important step and an additional tool to try and help those communities out. I welcome any questions that you all have, and thank you for your consideration of this bill.
Any questions?
I just have one.
Yeah. Vice Chair McClain.
I think we see a whole room full of people that, you know, need to continue talking. So please get a strategy and come back and let us know, you know, where the priority is. If you've got a list of 24 or 25 good things to do, then let's see what those top four or five are and make sure they're balanced.
Agreed.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, thank you. I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2297, 2241, And as the Vice Chair McLean said, we'll have to have some further discussion about, you know, where we go from here. But these aren't the only water bills. There's other water bills. So we may have to aggregate some of all of this into a work group. But if we can stick with Drought Task Force in the context of at least one of these bills and not both of them, that would be good. And, you know, dealing with Dash 1, Dash 2 together in one super amendment, even if it's in a different bill than either of these two, if the relating clause is too problematic, would be good, because we don't want people getting lost just on which bill, which amendment, whatever. We can find a vehicle. Let's just have a conversation, see if there's a path to move forward on things on a consensus basis, and if not, then we'll just have a little jury in my office, and we'll see who wins before we decide what gets brought back. Ooh. Okay, thanks a lot. I'm going to close the committee. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.